Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Mary Ellen Hannibal, and it is my pleasure to serve as the chair of the annual California Book Awards. Not only is Valerie charming, but she's incredibly competent. And I just want to give her, to start off with all the thanks that you'll be hearing us give tonight, Valerie and Mellon O'Keefe, who's over there. Mellon. These gals made this happen. It seems like a simple thing. It's all going well, but it takes months and months of a lot of bits and pieces put together, and they both did a really beautiful job, and I'm really grateful. Thank you so much. So welcome to the Book Awards. In fact, this is the 82nd annual California Book Awards, which since 1931 have honored writers residing in the state. What are the California Book Awards? Without question, after New York, California is the biggest producer of literature in the country. Most of this is not regional, per se. In our global age, the very idea of regional comes into question. We might ask, is there a terroir of writing produced here? But, of course, here we live in a place where the ground shuffles beneath our feet with frequency, and we embrace that. Going back in time, John Steinbeck, indeed, and Wallace Stegner were among the earliest winners of the award. Their work has become synonymous with the West. Amy Tan, Yi Yun Lee, and Karen Tay Yamashita have won the award, and that's almost a random selection of a cultural thread that runs through the award. There are many, many others for all these years, but their work reflects huge cultural shifts that over time have become part of the very warp and weft of what we call California. Writers like William Volman and Rebecca Solnit go very far afield indeed to bring us back definitions of place that integrate the local and the global. And tonight's winners take their own very important place in this trajectory of literature that is not regional per se, but represents the very particular vitality of this amazing state. So I'd like to start right now by asking the members of the jury who are here to just stand up and wave a little bit to the rest of everybody else. So what these jurors do is Herculean, and it takes months and months of work to do. We have about 13 or 14 jury members, and we divide into groups: fiction, nonfiction, poetry, young adult, juvenile. And the nonfiction jury also considers contribution to publishing and Californiana. So the groups go separately and each consider an avalanche of books unto themselves. So for the nonfiction books alone this year, there was like 130 titles. Overall, there were more than 400 titles submitted. And by the way, that's not even probably all the books that are published by major publishers that are by California writers. We are always making phone calls and saying, submit your book, you know, you're a California writer. So the juries, the small juries, then come up with three to five finalists, which we recommend to the rest of the jury. And then the whole jury reads all of the finalists. And then we have our last meeting in which we decide the winners. And that is really a fun meeting and a long one. So going into our final selection meeting, most of us have winners in our hearts, the books we think will get the prize. But quite often, we are wrong. We have a long, deliberate, fair, passionate discussion about all of the books. And one thing about this year's jury, which most members of this year's jury is not their first year. Some members think Alden has been a jury member for more than 15 years at least. But we have only, I think, one new person, which is Roz here. But all extremely attuned, I mean, very fairly attuned to what the writer's process is. What did this writer set out to do? What was their project? And how well did that writer fulfill their own ambition? So the jury members are editors, poets, librarians, professors of literature, all extremely invested in literature. You would absolutely never know that literature was ever under fire in any other quarter if you were to talk to our jury members. And when we actually come down to the winners, we've all been awakened to a new point of view, and we've seen things a little differently. It's a really fantastically dynamic process that gets the winners. So tonight, to begin tonight's festivities, I would like to thank the Bank of the West, which is the sponsor of the event, and that's a huge, big deal. We love a corporate sponsor, not only because it's what makes the award possible in many ways, but just, you know, literature is not just about talking to our own tribe. It's about really penetrating out into the rest of the world, which literature does over time percolate, and the Bank of the West is helping us to do that. And so I would like to ask Paul Weibley, whose name I usually mangle, but I've gotten it twice correctly tonight, right? Never mind. He's in charge of huge amounts of things, including lots of money, all of the loans that the lending that the bank does, and he is senior executive and vice president, head of national finance, Paul Weibley.
I'm going to be changing my name. Thank you so much, Mary Ellen, and what a thrill and honor it is to be here tonight. Before we start, I'd like to say that this is, I believe, my fourth time coming to host this, and it's one of my most favorite events. My wife is here with me tonight. Mary, our daughter and son would ordinarily be here. Because they, too, talk about this all year long. We often buy many of the books, and I'm sure that almost all of them get read as soon as they're home. I'm joined tonight by many colleagues from the bank, but I want to make sure that I recognize Mike Bracco and his wife, Kathy, who are here. Mike serves on the board. And also another, and it becomes important in just a moment, another colleague also serves on the bank's executive committee with me. Kirsten Guerin is here, and I'll come back to why that's important in a moment. We're going to have a little fun before we start. I get to present the first gold medal tonight, and it's going to be fun because we're giving the award to a former juror, which I know was a little unusual, but winning an award tonight is Dr. Martha Cox. Dr. Cox has made many, many indelible contributions to the life of literature. A longtime literary professor specializing in John Steinbeck studies, and she founded the Steinbeck Center at San Jose State University, the largest such center in the country to study Steinbeck. She also sponsors the Magic Theater here in San Francisco and has helped support the California Book Awards for years, amplifying in particular the First Fiction Award in the interest of encouraging fledgling writers. The awards tonight and for the many years before are vibrant because of her. So it's her exemplary service as a fiction juror that I would like to specially mention. For years that many of us can remember, Dr. Cox participated in the fiction selection process with an exemplary care and sensitivity to what Coleridge referred to as negative capability, a talent for appreciating work on its own terms. Her lifelong commitment to supporting and appreciating creativity has been a wonderful gift to California's writers, and thanks to her foresight will be continued for years. I'm going to ask Dr. Cox to come forward if you'd like, or I'll come to you. Here she is. Here's the award. Dr. Martha Cox, for your lifelong vision and commitment to literature and special support of the California Book Awards. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Let me help you back down.
Thank you.
So I'd mentioned Kirsten Guerin a moment ago. Here's why this is important. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to introduce to you Dr. Gabriel Miller. Dr. Gabriel Miller is the director of Raising a Reader. Now, it's important to know that the bank, through its Charitable Contributions Committee, Mike and I serve on that committee, got to know the organization Raising a Reader many years ago. And we started to talk about a way to use our charitable contributions, and there's never enough money, we know that, to support literacy. And of course, I have a fond spot in my life for libraries, and this was a terrific way to bring those two ideas together. Literacy, financial literacy, just general literacy, and support of libraries. Because what Dr. Miller's team does is a national nonprofit organization that helps families successfully build and sustain literacy routines in the home, and they also have these activities in libraries. Educators and parents across America are committed to including more and more of our students in the rich world of American literary life and all the important things that come from that. Now, Kirsten, as it turns out, the most recent member of the bank's executive committee, serves on the board of Raising a Reader. So I guess it's our own little 7 degrees of separation going on there as we get to know Raising a Reader. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Gabriel Miller.
Good evening. Thank you very much for having us, Paul. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'm joined this evening by my husband, Jeffrey, and our board chair, Dick Wilkolowski, and this is one of our favorite events of the year, too. I get to learn about the amazing work that you do, and I leave with an amazing book list every year, so just fabulous opportunity. I don't have to tell you what Raising a Reader is, because Paul just told you. So I'm very proud to lead a national organization that at more than 2,500 locations around the country does just what Paul said, help families develop the habit of sharing books. And we do that with these little red bags. And in each bag are four books. And each week those books go home, and each week families develop the habit of sharing books together. We're very, very proud that in 2012 we served our millionth child. It's amazing. A million human beings is a lot. We're very proud of that. And with the support of Bank of the West, and I might add they were our very first corporate sponsor, 4,000 of those children were connected to libraries so they and their families can continue the habit of sharing books with loved ones. So we're also very, very excited that we just launched a financial literacy program with the Bank of the West, and more than 200 children are already participating in that. So we're very, very proud of the work we do with Bank of the West. And they help us in just one way work with parents. They help us navigate so many of the should messages that we get. And we all get the should messages, and especially when you have a young child, it's very, very difficult to navigate all of it. But what I wanted to talk about tonight very briefly is that lately I've noticed that many of the should messages for parents focus on digital literacy. You should use digital books because if you don't, your child can't keep up with the latest technology. Or you shouldn't use them because children don't benefit from them as much as they do print books. It's been our experience that neither is true and both is true at the same time. We believe that the only should message is that children should have access to both. Now, I have to acknowledge that it's a bit blasphemous for me to say this here at an event like this. But, you know, I want to share what's happening with the national conversation because it's becoming much more nuanced, and it's fascinating. Even in the last few months, this past January, the Fred Rogers Center for Early Learning and Children's Media, so for those of you that don't remember, Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, so not surprisingly, there's a center for media studies, and they partnered with the National Association for the Education of Young Children, NAEYC. And so these are two very, very powerful thought leaders, and they took a look at what They presented a position paper on digital literacy for young children. And this is especially important because the only guidance we've had for many, many years is from the American Academy of Pediatrics, which said no screen time for children under the age of 3 and very, very limited up to age 5. So Fred Rogers and NAUIC took a look at all the research, they synthesized it, and offered a different but also very rigorous position that didn't focus on whether digital devices were good or bad, but it focused on how digital devices should be used with young children. They pointed to research that clearly showed the benefits of digital devices with young children if it's used to facilitate co-viewing. So adult and a child co-viewing, sharing a story. Or if there is an intentional purpose for instruction. So if you have you're a teacher and you use an iPad, there's an intentional instructional reason for it. And they considered both of these active uses of digital media. Then they contrasted those with what they called with passive uses of media. So putting the child in front of a TV or in front of a DVD player and no interaction. And in that regard, they completely agreed with the American Academy of Pediatrics that passive digital viewing does not serve children at all. So what's important here is that the discussion is moving beyond the, gee whiz, isn't this amazing technology and wouldn't it be great for kids, or the other extreme, which is children must be protected from all technology at all costs, to a renewed focus on what we're communicating and how we communicate it. The quality of the stories and the time we spend with each other, especially children, matters, not the medium. And that's something that's been true since long before digital devices were even on the horizon. So we come full circle. What matters is the quality of the stories and whether there is someone to share them, not whether we read them on a digital device or on a piece of paper. And that makes celebrations like this all the more important, as they remind us that the digital world isn't really all that new and brave without the content and the stories and the people we engage with and through those devices. Thank you all very, very much for your commitment to the craft of writing and for the very precious time that all of the judges and authors and their families, I might add, contributed to make this evening possible. Please know you have our profound respect, our sincere thanks, and for those of you who are accepting an award this evening, our very warmest congratulations. Thank you.
And now for the awards. Good evening. I'm Rosalind Chang, and I will be presenting the awards for juvenile and young adult literature. The list of finalists in all categories can be found in your program. Thanks to the generosity of publishers, over 140 titles were submitted for consideration in this year's juvenile and young adult categories. The challenge of selecting a winner in the juvenile category lies in the wide range of eligible books. The diverse ages covered by this category are those from birth and including age 10. My jury colleague, Grace Ruth, read all the entries and then solicited my input on her top choices. 5 finalists were then selected that fall across this age range, and they sparked lively discussion amongst the group as a whole. The finalists included 2 picture-based books, 1 a story for very young children, and 1 a nonfiction title in picture book format, and 3 text-based fictional stories for the upper ages. Our winner is Catherine Applegate for The One and Only Ivan, published by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Well known as the author of several best-selling series for children, such as The Animorphs, Catherine has crafted a heartwarming story narrated by an observant artistic gorilla who is a caged attraction in a shopping mall. While inspired by a real-life Ivan, this story is unique, memorable, and entirely Catherine's own. It has been also honored as the 2013 Newbery Award winner by the American Library Association. Congratulations to Catherine Applegate, the gold medal winner in juvenile literature for The One and Only Ivan.
Thank you for that lovely introduction. I am so delighted and grateful to be here, especially because book writers don't usually get to hang out with, children's book writers don't usually get to hang out with the grown-ups. And this is, although from what I gather, our parties are a lot better. The reception this year for Ivan, both from adults and from kids, has been really gratifying and heartening to me, particularly because I have a rather long and sordid history as a hack. My husband, Michael Grant, who's in the back hiding over there, and I have written over 150, we've lost count, books, some of them quite lovely, some of them pretty crappy, and over many, many, many years. We actually began our career writing two Harlequin romances. They're so much harder than they look like to write. And I'd love to tell you we were so solely motivated by our love of literature, but really we were just tired of living on top ramen and the one-ply toilet paper, and it was time to get a job. And so it seemed like an easy job. Little did we know. Michael and I wrote together. We wrote individually. We wrote a lot. After the romances, we were ghostwriters for several years, and we were positively ectoplasmic for a while. We wrote Sweet Valley Twins. We wrote Aladdin. We wrote for Disney like crazy. We did tons of Mickey Mouse. And we wrote books about girls who loved horses and horses who loved girls. And it was a long and tedious period in our lives. And then we came up with the idea for Animorphs and sold it. And it ended up being 60-plus books. So suddenly we went from being the people who were ghost writers to people who had ghost writers, which was an interesting transition. Now, this last month, we have gone from that point in our careers to both being on the New York Times bestseller list in the same month for different books that we had written individually. And that was kind of a nice moment because it was a long, hard slog. At its heart, an animal fantasy, and if I had a dollar for everyone, an adult who'd come up to me this year and said, I really, really loved Ivan, but I detest talking animal books, I could buy like a used Prius or something, because I didn't realize there was that kind of resistance to animal fantasies, because I grew up on Charlotte's Web. I thought they were great. But Ivan turned out, as I wrote it, to be very much about humans, which is true of most animal fantasies. They're about pain and sadness, but they're also about hope and resilience. And certainly The One and Only Ivan had some very tragic moments in it. It's based on a very dark, true story. There really was an Ivan. He was a gorilla who was lifted from the Democratic Republic of the Congo with a twin at about age 3 to 6 months by poachers, shipped to Tacoma, Washington, where he lived for 27 years in a cage. And I read about this story in the New York Times about 20 years ago, and it was so surreal and so bizarre and so heartbreaking that I cut it out, because that was back in the days when we had newspapers and you could cut things out. And I said, I'm going to write a story about this, but I could not figure out how I would tell it. And I hadn't written a lot of first-person gorilla, so it took me about 20 years to figure it out. At the end of the day, though, I found that what Ivan needed was a rather stoic, poetic, spare voice, and it worked. And the book, although it's a rather fat book and kids are usually a little intimidated when they see it, it's really a very quick read. The first chapter is about three lines, and that's because there's a lot of white space and some really lovely illustrations by Patricia Castileo that I think enhanced it. After The One and Only Ivan was published, I find this an interesting story. A local indie bookstore invited me to do a school visit. It was the Book Passage, which is a wonderful bookstore. And one of the parents was really, really worried because she'd heard that Ivan was sad and it might make the children sad. And she hadn't, of course, read the book because they never have actually read the book. The ones who object the most. And Book Passage, to its credit, responded thusly. They said, yeah, it's going to make them sad, and that's okay. Things aren't black and white in the world, and they shouldn't be in a children's novel either. As Madeline L'Engle said, you have to write the book that wants to be written. And if the book will be too difficult for grown-ups, then you write it for children. Thank you so much to the members of the jury, to the Commonwealth Club, and congratulations to my fellow writers, even if some of you do write for grown-ups.
Thank you, Catherine. Okay, and now for the young adult presentations. As with juvenile, the young adult category covers a diverse age range, which is from 11 to 16 years. To narrow the field, I read and turned to book reviews and best book recommendation lists from such sources as the New York Times, School Library Journal, Publishers Weekly, Booklist, Kirkus, and the American Library Association. Grace Ruth read my top choices, gave me much welcome feedback. Five finalists were selected and further discussed at a meeting with the entire California Book Award jury. This year's silver medalist is Marissa Moss for A Soldier's Secret, the incredible true story of Sarah Edmonds, a Civil War hero, published by Amulet Books. Told in a first-person narrative and combining fiction with biography, A Soldier's Secret is the tale of Sarah, who escapes from an arranged marriage and eventually masquerades as Civil War soldier Frank Thompson. Miss Moss gives Sarah a candid and prospective voice as we learn about the Civil War, the horror, the gore, the boredom, and true camaraderie from a soldier's point of view. Congratulations to Marissa Moss, the silver medal winner in young adult literature for A Soldier's Secret, the incredible true story of Sarah Edmonds, a Civil War hero. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. I have to say that I've been writing children's books for, I guess, 26 years now, and I've won a lot of awards, but I've never been to a ceremony for them because I haven't won a Newbery or Caldecott, so this is a real treat for me. And it's also an extra treat because, although I've written over 50 books, A Soldier's Secret is my first young adult. So to get recognition like this for a real leap for me is very validating. And I have to say that I also want to thank you because the picture book version of this, Nurse Soldier Spy, was a finalist last year. Didn't win, but okay, I made a finalist. And it tells you something about the story of Sarah. Now, I write a lot of historical fiction because I love history, and I feel like it's something that our kids don't get well enough in school. They get names and dates, but they don't get the juice. They don't get the story that's in history. So I try to put that story back in by giving them the real people that they might not know about. And when I started doing research for this book, I knew I was going to write about the Civil War, but I didn't know if it'd be North or South, man, boy, or woman. And then I found out that there were over 400 women who dressed as men and fought on one side or the other. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. And who are these women? And so I started to find the woman that I wanted to write about. And I wanted somebody who was fighting because she actually believed in the cause. And there were a lot of women who were there because they were with their brothers or husbands or fiancés or fathers. And a lot of them were there because they believed in the Union. Sarah was unusual because she actually believed that slavery was wrong. Now, she was also unusual because Sarah wasn't even American. She was Canadian. She left Canada to flee this arranged marriage, and she was living as a man already for 2 years. That's how she got by. So she was very good at her disguise when she enlisted. And she was also unusual because she wrote her own memoir. So I could read her own words, and you can read them too. It's called Unsexed in the Army. And it's an incredible story of, she doesn't mention that she's a woman actually in this whole book. You get it from the title. But it's really about the difficulty of being a soldier, no matter what your gender is. And then I also read diaries of other soldiers who served with her. She's incredible because not only was she a soldier, she was a battlefield nurse, which at the time was far too gory a job for a man. She was a general's adjutant, she was a postmaster, and she was a spy, which you can imagine she was very good at because she was really living that life already. So she would go on missions. The picture book version actually deals with her first mission where she dressed as an African-American. But other missions, she would dress as a woman. So she'd be a woman dressed as a man, dressed as a woman. So like a little Victor Victoria. She pulled that off very well, as you can imagine. But she was, to me, an incredible inspiration. And I wanted very much to get her story across because not only did she pull this off, she's the only woman who, having served, and there were 400 of them, as I said, she's the only one who, after her service, petitioned Congress and through two different acts was recognized as a veteran. She got a pension. She got an honorable discharge. She was mustered into the Grand Army of the Republic, and she was buried in a military cemetery. So she's truly an incredible person. And how many of you had heard of her before this book? Nobody. I mean, I didn't know about her. So this is what I delight in doing. I like finding these treasures of history and bringing them to life for kids because I think we all need the sense of history that matters. And Sarah Edmund Edmonds continues to be an inspiration to me. People like that whose stories deserve to be told, and I'll keep on looking for them to write for you. Thank you.
Okay, now for the gold medalist. This year's gold medalist is Morgan Mattson for Second Chance Summer, published by Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers. One unforgettable conversation with her parents dramatically changes the life of 17-year-old Taylor Edwards. She's informed that her father is terminally ill and has only a few months to live. The story of how the family spends one last summer together at their lake house, how Taylor reconnects with her mother, siblings, and former friends, and how she prepares for her father's death is told with much depth, beauty, pain, heart, and truth. Congratulations, Morgan Mattson, the gold medal winner in young adult literature for Second Chance Summer.
Thank you so much to the Commonwealth Club. I am just so amazed and touched and honored by this. Second Chance Summer, as Rosalind said, is a coming-of-age story that takes place all in a small lake community. And I wrote Second Chance Summer mostly as a reaction to my first book, Amy and Roger's Epic Detour, which is a cross-country road trip from California to Connecticut. And basically, I just wanted to write a book where everyone stayed in one place for the entire book. I was so sick of writing a new location every chapter. But Second Chance Summer it was a very difficult book to write. And I really, before I thought about writing it, I really considered, did I want to kind of really think about this? It's a book that's based on one of the most difficult chapters of my life. And so I really sort of thought a lot about if I actually wanted to put myself through this. But eventually I decided, I think sort of that is the calling of the novelist. And particularly for those of us who write for younger readers, I think we have to look into the darkest corners of our lives and shine some light there and craft some stories so that readers may find their own path a little brighter. So I hope I have done that, and I feel so honored to be recognized. Thank you so much to the jury and to the Commonwealth Club.
These tall people have a really different relationship to this mic. Is the sound okay? So I'm Sarah Rosenthal, and I'm one-third of the poetry posse that includes Justin Chin and Dean Rader. And we had five very compelling finalists for this year's gold medal in poetry listed in this evening's program for your perusal, and together they form a rich cross-section of poetry being written in the new millennium. And we earnestly recommend all of them to you for your summer reading. Ultimately, we selected Atel Adnan's Sea and Fog for the gold medal. We chose it for its generous and deeply integrated vision of our world. It has a vision built on considerable knowledge of literary and geopolitical history, a love of surrealism and the subconscious, the poet's experiences as a woman and a displaced person, and a consuming interest in mortality. Adnan is in her late 80s. Sea and Fog comprises a series of prose paragraphs and lineated poems which describe ocean and fog as real features of landscape, as metaphors of mind, and even as friends and lovers with whom we seek intimacy. The book is both a call of warning to care for one another and our exquisite endangered planet, and an invitation to commune deeply with the nature in and around us, in a world where us includes sea, includes fog. Quote, "The universe could have taken myriads of roads other than the one it took. It's exiled too." Atel Adnan is the author of numerous books of poetry and prose, including Sit Marie Rose, and the recipient of a 2010 Penn Oakland Josephine Miles National Literary Award. For many years, she has divided her time between Sausalito, Beirut, and Paris. And Paris is the city that holds her presence this evening. So I want to congratulate Atel Adnan, the gold medal winner in Poetry for Sea and Fog, published by Nightboat Books. And because Atel isn't here tonight, Steve Dickison, who's the director of the Poetry Center at the San Francisco State University, has graciously offered to accept it. So here you are, Steve.
Thank you, Sarah. It's a real honor to do this for Atel, and I've really had the great pleasure of knowing her for 20-some years. And were she here tonight, you would all be remarkably charmed and moved by her presence. Atel has a long history with the San Francisco Bay Area. She came here as a student at UC Berkeley in the 1950s, and sometime after completing her master's degree, she walked into Dominican College over in San Rafael and said to them, "You know, you have a philosophy department, but you don't teach American philosophy. What's that about?" And she proposed that she would do that, and she went on to do that and other things at Dominican College for about a decade. In the early 70s, she decided to go back to Beirut, where she worked as a journalist, a remarkably bold journalist, because the Civil War erupted during her period there, and her life was put at risk by what she wrote. She wrote an extraordinary novel called Sit Marie Rose, which is known the world over. In the Arab world, it's been translated into multiple languages, all the European languages, many editions. Her publisher for many years was Simone Atel here in Sausalito, and this book is brought into print by Nightboat Books. It carries a beautiful painting by Atel on the cover. And right now, I'd encourage everyone to get over to the Wattis Gallery, which is CCA's new gallery that is open on Kansas Street at 16th. And there's, as long as I've known Atel, I've never seen an exhibit of her paintings, and this is just that. And besides that, they've brought together her journalism, originally written in French for the Beirut newspapers, and published that in book form. There are a thousand things one could say about Atel. She has led an extraordinarily remarkable life. Somebody asked me about her a few minutes ago, and I said, well, you know, she sits down with people like Pier Paolo Pasolini or Pablo Neruda. And her life has been like that all the way through her life. It's just a remarkable conversationalist in a very old school way that one doesn't see very much these days. So just an exceptional woman. I'm going to just, to give you a taste of the work, read from the very beginning of the book and the very end. This is the first part of C. These are two long poems, mostly in prose. C is to Simone Fatal. The sea, nothing else. Walls ruptured. Sea, water tumbling. Oil, transparency, the sea, field of stirring liquid, gathering of pouncing waves going to battle, into one's mythology. Trees intrude, expand, shed shadows. And from the end of Fog, O my soul, am I you? When I'm talking to you, it's because I think you will listen, knowing you might not. But the involvement with you is fatal. Every window thinks of itself as being an opening. So on behalf of Attell, thank everyone very much for the Commonwealth Club and Sarah Rosenthal and the other members of the panel.
Hello, everyone. My name is Stephen Saum, and I'm the editor of Santa Clara Magazine and a member of the nonfiction jury. The nonfiction jurors, we read the true stories, were headed up by Mary Ellen Hannibal, who is also the overall head of the jury for the California Book Awards. One of the special awards that the California Book Awards have presented for years has to do with the people and places, the stories of the past and the present and the stories that are still unfolding that are right here all about the Golden State. And we call this award Californiana. Like California itself, that covers a lot of territory still. And tonight, here in the heart of San Francisco, we honor a book that's grounded in the City of Angels, Sunshine Was Never Enough, by John H.M. Lazlett, Professor Emeritus of History at University of California, Los Angeles. He's offered a sweeping history of the labor movement in L.A. with a narrative arc that reaches from the 1880s to the beginning of the 21st century. He captures so much of what we make and build and sell and how we make a living. There's the bombing of the Los Angeles Times building in 1910 and the violence of class warfare. There's the New Deal, the Cold War, the high-tech boom. There is the beautiful Los Angeles where movies are made set against the gritty reality. John Lazlett's the author and co-author of many books, including Labor and the Left and Colliers Across the Sea. So congratulations to Professor Lazlett, gold medal winner in Californiana for Sunshine Was Never Enough. Now, Dr. Lazlett can't be here tonight, so his nephew, Owen Wendland, will accept on his behalf. I should pose for the camera. There you go.
Thank you. good evening. My name is Owen Wendland, and I'm John Lazlett's nephew. It's an honor for me to be here today, and I'm very grateful for the generous hospitality you've shown me this evening as I accept this award for the 2012 Best Book on California History on behalf of my uncle, John Lazlett, who I love very dearly. He and I discussed his book from time to time during the years when he was researching and writing it. When you read it, you will sense his passion for history and his dedication to the labor movement. While John is an intellectual in the finest sense, he's also a very warm individual who enjoys nothing more than a good conversation, which is why I know he would have very much liked to have been here tonight to accept this distinguished award. Unfortunately, he has a longstanding concurrent engagement in England and could not be here with us tonight, and John gave me the following remarks about his book and asked if I would read them. Sunshine Was Not Enough, Los Angeles Workers, 1880 to 2012, which he considers his best book, offers a counter-narrative to the story of Southern California as the iconic frontier of Hollywood, sunny beaches, and laid-back ease. The book also casts its net more widely than previous works, covering the citrus and oil industries to the north of Los Angeles and going down to the Mexican border, where many poorly paid maquiladoras, poor Mexican girls assembling computer parts for the high-tech industry, lived and worked as part of the Pacific Rim economy. It tells the story of men and women, both immigrant and native-born, who pumped oil, loaded ships in Long Beach Harbor, built movie sets, assembled aircraft, and in more recent times, cleaned hotels and washed cars. Intriguingly, at a time when many people believe that organizations such as the AFL-CIO is on its last legs, Lazlett shows how in recent years, public employee and service unions such as the SEIU, led by a new generation of Mexican, Asian, and Black union leaders, have bucked the nationwide trend. They have made LA the one place in America where the labor movement is still growing. Is this just an anomaly or a spinoff of Mexican-American demand for immigration reform? Or is this something more? If you read this book, you will find out. I know he's incredibly grateful for this award, so thank you again.
So there's a truism that editors and publishers feel ever more keenly these days, right, in an increasingly digital age. And that's when you go to the trouble of putting ink on paper, you better make something beautiful. Which brings us to the gold medal for notable contribution to publishing. Valley of Shadows and Dreams is a book of light and wonder, illuminating dark truths. Publisher Heyday has brought to the page an object rare and arresting through the photography of Ken Light and the words of Melanie Light. There emerge portraits of the Central Valley, the land and its lives, the trees and trailers, the furrows and flags, the tattoos and tumbleweeds, the pickers of citrus, grapes, and asparagus, tales that are intimately personal and biblically epic. To all, Malcolm Margolin, publisher of Heyday, Ken and Melanie Light, thank you for all the labor that goes into this gift that takes us by the shoulders, sits us down and says, you've got to see this, really see this. Congratulations to Ken and Melanie Light and to Heyday, gold medal winners and notable contribution to publishing for Valley of Shadows and Dreams.
Thank you. I wanted to thank, first of all, my wife, Melanie. It was Melanie who traveled into the Valley in 2005 to do research for a museum catalog she was writing and soon realized that an amazing story was unfolding and invited me to join her in trying to tell it. We had many supporters who made this book possible, and I might add, finding early support to get out into the field for a writer and a photographer is probably one of the hardest parts of doing this kind of book, a book of words and photographs. One of the earliest supporters was Ben Jealous, who, as the executive director of the Rosenberg Foundation, asked us at a lunch we had with him, what were we doing these days? And then he offered us an unsolicited grant to support what would become the work that was in Valley of Shadows and Dreams. Of course, this was just enough money to get us into trouble, as for those of you who have gotten grants. And it started us on a four-year journey of writing and photographing in the San Joaquin Valley. Ben asked if we could write a pitch so he could write a check. And he said, keep it short. And we wrote, long imperiled, the California Central Valley seems to be coming to a crossroads as massive new housing developments spring up like a new crop on the most fertile, productive agricultural land in the United States. The Valley has been the economic hub of California for generations, as well as its physical center. While various factions politic in Sacramento over land use, pollution, water rights, and labor laws, the fabric and quality of the life in the Valley is undergoing a tremendous shift, impacting millions of people whose labor has contributed to California's wealth, but whose stories have remained largely unseen and unheard. And we concluded our narrative with the issues of the Central Valley are covered by the media, but never with the intense scrutiny and focus that independent journalists can bring to this complex region on the purposes of change that will fundamentally affect the future of all Californians. This project will be a personal face on the people and communities directly affected and bring that intimate portrait into the mainstream. So after 5 years of doing this project, we witnessed water wars, immigration marches, drought, orchards being pulled out and replanted, massive home foreclosure, a huge wave of unemployment, food lines, clusters of illnesses in communities, harvests, struggle, and bursts of sheer joy. Young kids swinging over the San Joaquin River, like the image on the cover of the book, couples dancing in cantinas, celebrating life. We saw all these things. And here we are 8 years later with a body of work that we threw our heart and minds into creating. And there were, again, a lot of people along the way who I'd like to just quickly mention who helped make the book possible, and that would be Susie Katz and Photo Wings, Peter Buckley, Stuart Alexander, Joyce Linker, Sandra Phillips of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Arts, and a wonderful foreword written by Tom Steinbeck, John's elder son, which was unbelievable. And one day, Melanie and I were talking in the kitchen about who we might get to write, and Melanie had just read East of Eden, and you know, thank God for Google. We Googled John Steinbeck, and it said, oh, he has a son who was a photographer and a writer, and he lives in California. And we looked at each other, and Melanie said to me, or I said to Melanie, do you think he might write a foreword? And I said, well, let's call him. So the Steinbeck Center in San Jose gave us his Tom's phone number, and we called, and Tom answered the phone. And he says, hi, I'm Tom Steinbeck. And I said, hi, you know, we're doing this book about the Central Valley. And Melanie's writing, I'm doing the photographs, and we're wondering if you would be willing to write the foreword. And he said, of course I'd like to write the foreword. This is one of the most important issues there is. And so we were so lucky to have him join us in this venture. Also, we'd like to thank Malcolm Margolin and the Heyday family. They were such an important part of this book, working with us, struggling with us, seeing that the words were edited, the photographs were sequenced and beautifully printed. And again, I'd like to thank Melanie, who was the intellectual center of this project, which is so evident in her writing, and really most importantly to the community of organizers and Valley people who opened our eyes and hearts and really pointed us and shared their world and stories that are the Valley of Shadows and Dreams. Thank you. Melanie?
I'll just briefly follow up and tell you a little bit of a different aspect. Thank you so much for having us and for honoring us with this award. It's really very meaningful to me personally. And I think also, I just want to take a moment to speak on behalf of all writers, really. So even though The Valley of Shadows and Dreams has been a great success, we had coverage by Newsweek and the New York Times, I felt strangely disconnected from all of that hoopla. I mean, it was so important for it to get out, but it's so weird. Once you write something and it's out in the world, it just, I don't know, you feel disconnected. And I think part of that is due to the internet and the way the media have evolved in this digital age. Honestly, it sounds really ridiculous, but bear with me. The landscape for a content provider looks actually a lot like the landscape for an agricultural worker. And by that, I mean that there's a lot of power aggregated at the top. There's lots of need for the work, but the pay is low to no. And there's really not a lot of dignity or respect along the way. It's hard, and it's all of, yes, I'm nodding. People are nodding. So you have to understand how important these awards are. And until I had really experienced this, I never realized it either. On most dates, I feel like it's a privilege for me to just follow my nose and go out into the world and say, hey, look, this is really interesting, and I think people should know about this. But it can wear you down. And this project was hard, and I have to say, without Ken being sort of the, the bull that would just keep persisting and pushing and pushing and pushing, it wouldn't have happened, because there are half a dozen times where I'm like, oh, screw it. I mean, really, come on. There's other things in life. But after the book was published, we had this event, a book event, down in Fresno at Arte Americas, which is mostly for indigenous folk there. And a lot of the people who served as guides for us came to this event. And we're supposed to have a moderator for like this panel. And his name is Hugo Morales. And he's the founder of Radio Bilingue, which is this amazing resource for Hispanic folk. And he actually gave up the probably pretty nice life he could have had with his Harvard Law degree to sort of work for the Hispanic, indigenous people and agricultural workers in California and throughout the West. And so he was supposed to do like a 5-minute introduction, and we were going to take over and kind of blah, blah, blah. But he he's talked for the whole hour. He was, this book, had, it was like it had given him license to just unleash a lifetime of frustration. It was like the book validated his work and gave him an even stronger voice. And then when we brought books to give to our guides. And honestly, it was just better than Christmas. I mean, their whole bodies would come alive when we gave them these books. I'm kind of getting emotional. Because they work in complete isolation out in the valley. You know, the ruling elite that they're trying, they're knocking on the door, and they're really deaf and dumb to their concerns. So for an outsider to come and say, look, this is important, and we've recorded your story here, was really quite powerful. And so you all need to understand that your support of the arts reaches deep, deep, deep into the community and beyond. It's just so important. And I learned that through this project, and hopefully I will be doing more projects. But so I also wanted to say thank you to our supporters, and that they supported us, but then they're also supporting all these other people with that. And again, I'll just echo some of these names: Susie Katz, Stuart Davidson, and Peter Buckley for supporting the publication, and Malcolm, who actually took the book mostly on Ken's photos because I hadn't really written much at that point. And so I'm grateful to his faith and vision for that, and the whole Haydig team, of course. And then I wanted to thank the people at the Center for Investigative Reporting who took the work, and Sharon Tiller and Carrie Ching, who created a multimedia piece that just spread all over the place and was a beautiful, wonderful tool to help get the word out. And then, of course, I want to thank the jury here at the Commonwealth Club for just taking this so seriously. And it's just such an important thing for us all. Thank you.
Hi, me again. Don't you already want to start talking about this? I mean, it's really kind of amazing. It's California. It's this huge state. It's just one year, just this agglomeration of writers, and yet all of these symmetries and connections between them. And, you know, in a huge part, what they've just presented, Ken and Melanie, and Martha, who made the Steinbeck Center at San Jose State University possible. And, you know, that's just talk about really this commitment to literature and what it means over the years. So thanks again to Martha. So I'm going to go on to the nonfiction awards and start with our silver. And the silver and the gold, not to take anything away from the gold award winners, but the silver award winners, you can feel just as good as if you got a gold, because all the finalists in the category should all get a gold. You know, it's almost impossible to choose. It's like really slicing and dicing. But for the nonfiction silver, is going to The Lady in Gold. And The Lady in Gold is, as the subtitle says, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch Bauer. While reading this book, I kept looking at the cover. Klimt's work is so singular and magical, so familiar. There she is, Adele, in a sea of kaleidoscopic colors and patterns that richly evoke the painting's time and place, turn of the century Vienna. The painting was stolen by the Nazis, as was so much else. And yet, decades after some of the worst destruction this world has ever seen, the painting is still here. Adele still looks out at us. Anne-Marie O'Connor applies expert reportorial skills in ferreting out and telling the tragic story of how this painting was lost and the heroic story of how it was recovered. And in doing so, she testifies, as Adele does, to the transcendence of art itself. So the Silver Award in nonfiction goes to Anne-Marie O'Connor for The Lady in Gold.
thank all of you so much for this honor. It's so great to get recognition in my one-time hometown of San Francisco, where I went to art school with the dead Kennedys, lived in Harvey Milk's district, went to one of Allen Ginsberg's poetry premieres, taught English as a second language at Commodore Stockton Grade School in Chinatown, and took women's studies from Angela Davis. Don't tell anyone. This is where I first studied the Lady in Gold, the beautiful portrait model who was described in those days as one of Gustav Klimt's decadent Viennese society women. So I was surprised years later when I met Maria Altman, a Los Angeles woman who was trying to get back Klimt's famous gold portrait of her aunt from Austria. It had been stolen by the Nazis. According to Maria, the women in Klimt's portraits were not dull society ladies. They were intellectuals, friends of Klimt. Her aunt might have had a thing with Klimt. The story involves Sigmund Freud, Billy Wilder, and Hedy Lamarr. And according to Maria, the women in Klimt's paintings, the famous portraits, were Jewish. This saga was not just a restitution of art. It was a restitution of history. I was able to tell this story in part because UC Berkeley paid for me to finish my education here years ago. I was working my way through, and this was life-changing for me. So it feels like a homecoming to be here tonight in the place that launched me. And at a time of shrinking budgets, I'm happy to see that California continues to invest in its people. Thank you so much for honoring the Lady in Gold.
Okay, here's a periodic reminder for the radio audience. This is the Commonwealth Club of California, and tonight we are celebrating the 82nd Annual California Book Awards with the winning authors. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and also see video of the programs online at Fora TV. So we have our quirks on the nonfiction jury, our preferences. This is a memoir, remarked one of our nonfiction jurors, but I like it anyway. Is it a memoir, remarked another? I think it is a history of healthcare in our country, of Laguna Honda Hospital, of San Francisco itself. Don't forget, it is also a meditation on the difference between medieval and contemporary medicine, what has been lost and what has been gained in becoming modern, piped up another juror. The book in question is God's Hotel, A Doctor, a Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine by Dr. Victoria Sweet. Whatever this book may be in its deftly woven parts, in sum, it is a compelling personal odyssey through sickness, compassion, and care. It is one of those sui generis special books, both charming and consequential. And I'd like to add that Dr. Sweet gets some kind of special distinction tonight for traveling most miles in a day. If anyone has traveled more today, let me know and I will take it back. But this morning she did grand rounds at Harvard Medical School in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And she flew all the way, the time change in her favor, so she could be with us tonight. So we're so glad you could make it. And congratulations to Dr. Victoria Sweet, the gold medal winner in nonfiction for God's Hotel.
I love medals. Ever since I was a kid, I've loved medals. I don't even hardly know where to start. I guess I'll start with saying how thrilled I am to be here, that I made it, thanks to United, amazingly enough. And how thrilled I am to be here and get this award from the Commonwealth Club. I'm a fourth-generation Californian. And my mother, who's here, is a third-generation San Franciscan. And my great-grandfather belonged to the Commonwealth Club in the 1920s. And I think there's something about the Commonwealth Club I was thinking about as I was listening to everybody. I have an immense sort of feeling about the Commonwealth Club, and I think part of it is the same feeling I have about Laguna Honda. They're both kind of quirky. You know, when I was back at Harvard and I was explaining to them what this was and why I was going to go,
The guy I was with, who's, you know, very intellectual and very well read, he said, the Commonwealth Club. I mean, I honestly, as a Californian, I thought everybody knew what the Commonwealth Club was. He goes like, oh, is that some kind of San Francisco men's club? You know, and I was sort of horrified. I'm like, no, it's really important. Teddy Roosevelt spoke at the Commonwealth Club, and Franklin Roosevelt. So I was sort of surprised, but it is a little quirky in the same way. Quirky may not be the right word. It's a very definite kind of place that I think is unique. Maybe that's a better word. And Laguna Honda was the same kind of place. You know, I got there accidentally. I'm a doc. I'd been a doc for quite a few years. I'd gotten interested in pre-modern medicine because it seemed like pre-modern medicine was the missing piece of Western medicine. You know, Western medicine is logical and methodical and it's wonderful, and we're always sort of labeled as missing this sort of holistic piece. When I started reading the medical work of a 12th century nun named Hildegard of Bingen, it was like the missing piece. So I got very intrigued. I decided to do a PhD, and I needed to only be able to practice medicine half the time. And the only place I could find in the whole place was Laguna Honda, which I'd never been to, and it was willing to let me practice medicine part-time. But when I went over for my interview and saw it for the first time, I was just stunned. It didn't look like a hospital at all. It looked like a monastery. It was huge. It was on 60 acres of land with 1,200 patients on those old-fashioned open Nightingale wards. So I never... You know, I told the medical director I would come for 2 months. And I ended up staying for more than 20 years. And for a long time, I thought that was just an accident, or really that it was just convenient. And it took a sabbatical, like it so often does, you know, getting away from something. I went for a year to Switzerland. I got offered a job at the University of Geneva, which as a visiting professor, which had been sort of a dream of mine. And I turned it down. I missed Laguna Honda. I missed its patients. And it was the first time I kind of was conscious that there was something very special about Laguna Honda, its patients, its staff, the whole place. And that's how this book came into being, because I started thinking about it at that point. And then Laguna Honda, the old Laguna Honda, was discovered by the Department of Justice, and they were horrified, and they wanted to tear it down. And eventually, you know, they insisted that San Francisco rebuild a new modern healthcare facility, which it did. And most of the time, I just worked on my Hildegard thesis and just sort of took care of my patients and thought about things and kind of started seeing all these connections. But I didn't really think about writing about it until one day I was driving in and I saw the new buildings rising from the valley. And that was the first time I realized that when they were finished with the new buildings and the patients had moved in and they tore down the old building, that what I'd experienced there, nobody would even believe it. And it was at that moment I got determined to, if I could, to capture what I'd felt, understood there. And that's when I started writing. But I never thought it would end up as this book and I would get this award. Or that the kind of excitement around this book would have happened. And part of it's happened because of the patients and the story I have to tell. But part of it has happened because of where we're at in healthcare. I think if I'd written this book 5 years ago or 5 years from now, it would be okay, right? But where we're at now, we're at a crux time. And some of the messages that I learned at Laguna Honda are crucial for us to understand now and take into account with all the stuff that's happening. What kind of messages? Well, for instance, the big overwhelming one that I learned, which was that medicine is personal. And that when it's personal, it works. And when it's not personal, you know what? It doesn't really work. It's a simulacrum of working. And I think the overriding word, especially towards the end, as I was walking around the wards, and it was all kind of dissolving, you know, as the building was going up and all this stuff was happening, I gradually realized that the essence of the place that I felt was a sense of kindness. almost in the walls. They were in the volunteers. It was even in the patients. It was in the staff. There was a sense of kindness. What do I mean kindness? Of taking care of one another. And because I like words, I thought about the word kindness. And I thought, what's the etymology of kindness, right? And it turns out it comes from the word kind. Not being nice, but how you treat somebody who is of your own kind. So kindness means when you know that somebody's your relative, you treat them a certain way. So kindness is the sense you have of somebody who's related to you, who's close to you. And the thing about Laguna Honda is to have that sense of kindness was because there was a sense that everybody was kind of related to everybody else. There wasn't this huge gap, staff here, administrators there. There was a sense of taking care of one another. And that's kind of the essence of when I think about it now, of what I remember. So the last thing I'll say before I thank a few people is that every time I talk in Northern California, somebody comes up to me and says, I worked at Laguna Honda, and you just got it just right. Or I was a patient at Laguna Honda, and you got it just right. Or I had a family member there. And that always reassures me that it's not some fantasy land that I created, that it really was like I have it in the book. It was a kind place. So I would very much like to thank the jurors for selecting God's Hotel. It is truly meaningful to me, and I'd like to thank Riverhead for publishing, and my editor, Becky Salatin, for being a great editor, and my agent, Mary Evans, who really pointed me in the right direction. So thank you very much.
Good evening. My name is Catherine Ma, and I will be presenting the awards in First Fiction and Fiction. Thank you first to my fellow jurors, Peter Fish, Sarah Manica, and Fiction Jury Chair, Oscar Villalon, for their insight and their love of books. Together, we read deeply, we debated over email and at the kitchen table, and selected the finalists. Our tastes and perspectives vary widely, which makes the process more satisfying to us all. And this year was thrilling. We had so many wonderful books to choose from. In selecting our finalists, I think each of us had our heart broken at least a couple of times. But in the end, we affirmed that California's writers are bringing us brilliantly rendered stories of our collective past, present, and future. This year's silver medalist in First Fiction is Mariah K. Young for Mash'Allah and Other Stories, also published by Heyday Press. Set in East Oakland, these nine stories bring us into varied worlds of characters different in background, but alike in need. We meet recent immigrants and old souls, bartenders, hairdressers, hired drivers, and day laborers all trying to make their own luck. It's a wonderful debut from a clear-eyed writer with a fresh and honest voice. Congratulations to Mariah K. Young, the Silver Medal winner in First Fiction for Mash'Allah and Other Stories.
Thank you so much. Wow, I get a medal. Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much. My goodness, I don't really know where to begin. I wrote some things, and now all of the words are kind of falling out, right? I'll just say I'm so happy to be here. I'm so happy to be home. I've been in L.A., and it's so nice to be back here in San Francisco. And to get this award for my writing, which is so much about the Bay Area, this place that I grew up in, this place that I love. So I'm delighted to receive this. And thank you so much to all of the jurists, all the readers. I can't imagine a more esteemed group to be looking at my work. So, and also readers who love this state and love her stories as much as we all do, right?
writing this book was so much about capturing the sense of place, the sense of what Oakland was about, this place that most people can disregard in terms of headlines or that kind of falls in the shadow of the city, right? So, you know, I was really glad to show a side of Oakland that is so often overlooked and to show a place where people are rooted just as much in community and in family and in loyalty. And one of the readers said that reading the book was like going through a neighborhood, and it's just what I wanted. I was so happy with that. So thank you to the readers. Thank you so much to Heyday. There's Gail. Thank you to Gail, my editor, who is so careful and generous with my work. Thank you to Malcolm Margolin, who I can't imagine a better hands to be guiding my work and to have this first book with me. So I'm so lucky to have Heyday as a home. And so I wouldn't be here literally without my mom, who came from Maui to be here to support me tonight. She had me writing as soon as I could hold a pen. So thanks, Mama. And I have some good dear friends here, someone who read the first couple drafts of the book and someone who read it right as I was pushing it out to publish. So I wouldn't be here without you. And I wouldn't be here without all of you who create such a vibrant community and a place where people who write about California can find a home and to have these stories really kind of glisten and shimmer. You know, so thank you so much. Thank you for this. This is going to make me write the next one. So thank you.
This year's gold medalist in first fiction is Jennifer Dubois for A Partial History of Lost Causes, published by Random House. The jury's initial response to this novel was, how can this possibly be a first book? The writing is so skillful and the theme so broad, it seems the work of a more mature writer. In fact, Jennifer was just 26 when she wrote this book. This story of a young woman facing terminal illness and a Russian chess master turned dissident is unafraid to tackle large subjects such as history, politics, mortality, and love. Its treatments of Russia and the West are penetrating and wise. We're pleased to be among the first to recognize the significant achievement and promising future of this marvelous writer. And Jennifer told me tonight she has a second novel coming out this October. Congratulations to Jennifer Dubois, the gold medal winner in first fiction for A Partial History of Lost Causes.
Thank you so much for this. This is such an honor and such a thrill for me. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club and the jurors and to my husband, Justin, and also to my editor, David Ebershoff, who flew in from New York, which I think speaks to his dedication as an editor. So A Partial History of Lost Causes arose really when two lifelong preoccupations of mine kind of revealed themselves to be fundamentally sort of the same one in a strange way, which is I had the chance to go to Russia as a small child, and that sparked sort of a lifelong interest for me in Eastern Europe and geopolitics. And as a reader and writer of fiction, I found that I'm always very drawn to narratives that braid the personal with the political or the historical. That sort of always feels sort of uniquely satisfying to me as a reader, I think. And a few years ago, when I read about Garry Kasparov, who's the chess champion turned political dissident in Russia, who was running a kind of quixotic, doomed presidential campaign against Vladimir Putin back in 2007, I was very drawn to that character arc, and that's where the basis for Alexander Bezatov came from. But I also, I think, more particularly, was very drawn to the question of, if this fellow sort of knows he's not likely to actually win over Vladimir Putin, you know, what exactly is he trying to do? What's the sort of value of what he's attempting? And I think the reason that that question was so resonant for me personally was because my father, when I was growing up, had Alzheimer's disease. So I sort of confronted some of the questions that the character Arena, who has Huntington's disease, confront in terms of what do you do when you know that a situation is not going to end well. Some of those questions then become Arena's questions in the book. But I also had the kind of inspiring experience of having the chance to watch my mother's care of my father, which was, in a strange way, and a very different scale, kind of a similar effort to trying to beat Vladimir Putin. You know, she cared for him in ways that nobody was going to see and that he wasn't going to know and that wasn't going to change anything at the end of the day, but that still had real value and significance. And I think that in sort of an odd way, that's sort of the through line that brought those two characters together in my mind and into this book, which I'm, again, very grateful to have honored here. So thank you so much. Again, this is really great.
In choosing the finalist for fiction, we were gloriously, deliriously happy. The field was deep and the contenders exciting. Thank you to the numerous authors who provided the jury with many hours of provocative thought and reading pleasure. This year's gold medalist in fiction is Adam Johnson for The Orphan Master's Son, published by Random House. And as Jennifer said, we're also honored that present today is David Ebershoff of Random House in New York, editor to both Adam Johnson and Jennifer Dubois. Thank you to David and to your colleagues at Random House for your commitment to supporting writers and literature. In 2003, the California Book Awards presented the gold medal in fiction to Adam Johnson for his first novel, Parasites Like Us. Here was a remarkable writer exploring with wit and bravado the trenchant issues of our day. In The Orphan Master's Son, the wit is intact, the bravado turned into fearlessness, the vision dark and bracing. The story of Park Jun-do's progress through the brutal maze of North Korea military and political institutions is a mix of the ordinary and the surreal. The novel places significant demands on the reader, but the effort is rewarded with a comic, hallucinatory, always powerful portrait of oppression's effect on individual lives. Congratulations to Adam Johnson, the gold medal winner in fiction for The Orphan Master's Son, published by Random House.
You don't know how tempting that gavel is, but I know you've got to earn that. What a wonderful evening. Thanks to everyone who came out tonight. I was here in 2003, and you know, none of my writing had ever been recognized in that way, and it was the first time I really thought that I might be on the right path. And it's really fantastic to be here again. It means a lot to me. To be here with all these fabulous writers who've achieved so much, to be nominated in the class of writers like Michael Chabon and Dave Eggers is something I don't even know how to speak to, honestly. To the jurors who read, to all the readers, thank you. I hope I didn't give you nightmares. But what a wonderful place to be a writer. If there's a finer place to be a writer, I don't know it. It's a town of great booksellers, of great readers. You can see the spirit of the literary community here. And I'm thankful to everyone, especially the Commonwealth Club, who's hosting this place tonight. And I know they're going to go all upscale with a new facility. But my heart will always be here. You know, I don't have much to say other than that, you know, I wondered almost every day for many years, who was I, a fairly average dude in California, to write a novel set in North Korea and to tell the stories of people whose experience were so, you know, far from my own. But since we're in a room filled with book lovers, I'll share that I discovered over my research that it's a place where people aren't allowed to tell their own stories. Only the regime's story is approved. where writers can't write and readers cannot read. And as I studied North Korea for years, I came to see it's an utterly voiceless place. And I came to feel the opposite, that I hope, you know, more people come to the challenge of telling a story of a place where people have had their stories taken from them. We're never even allowed to utter them. And I don't know if my version is the right version, but hopefully the more versions, the better, and the bigger the discussion. I'd be happy to answer questions on the end of the event, which is always the best part, at the reception. People may want to know, did Kim Jong-il really drink $700,000 worth of cognac a year? People will want to know whether Kim Jong-il really did like to kiss his sushi chef naked in the sauna once a week. Did Kim Jong-il really eat puppy soup every Sunday? You may also want to know if, you know, there really are family gulags there. So I'll answer all those. Thanks for coming out tonight, and thanks for the honor. Thanks.
Okay, thanks everybody, especially to you incredibly wonderful writers. I'm so struck with Victoria. All of you have made, you know, very moving comments that just bring your books back to me. And what an incredible experience, vertiginous. But Victoria's comments about kindness, I mean, literature is kind. It makes us all kin, and with animals like Ivan as well, and back through time to kin in other generations, forward and backward. So, yay, literature. Thank you, guys. So thank you to everybody that needs thanks and wants it. after this, you know, after talking about books, we have dessert. What could be better? Okay, ready? I get to do this. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.